Hello and welcome to the Technically Legal Podcast. This is podcast episode 108 for July 5th, 2011. I'm Ben Snitkoff.
I'm Dominic Rabbi.
And I'm David O'Brien.
As usual, we've got three stories for you. First, we're going to talk about Brown v. the Entertainment Merchants Association, case recently decided by the Supreme Court. Next, we're going to talk about Dropbox changing their terms of service. And finally, a possible Federal Trade Commission investigation of Twitter. So starting things right off, we're going to dive into this Supreme Court story. So we've covered this before on the podcast and on the website. California had passed a law that prohibited the sale or rental of violent video games to minors. Entertainment Merchants Association, group of companies that develop and distribute video games, challenged that law in federal court. And the law was struck down as violating the First Amendment. The case was taken by the Supreme Court, presumably to resolve a split in the circuits and states about whether or not video games are protected under the First Amendment. And it was argued in November, and due to a rather contentious split in the court about how to even decide this case, it was not decided until this past Monday, June 27th. So the split was kind of interesting. Five justices said that the law violated the First Amendment, and video games can never be regulated the way this law tries to regulate them. Two justices, Alito and Chief Justice Roberts, said that video games can be regulated, but this law was vague. And finally, Justice Thomas said that children have no right to speech or to either speak or to be spoken to. And then Justice Breyer said that the law was well supported and that it should have been upheld. So before we get into any more details here, any initial thoughts from the panel?
Well, it's an interesting case. I think the holding, though, was not very surprising.
Right, and I think pretty much everyone thought that this law was going to be struck down. The question was how and who was going to dissent. Originally, there was a thought that what was holding up this case was that Justice Alito was going to be writing a big dissent, because Alito does not have a particularly broad view of the First Amendment. We later found out that while Justice Alito does not have a particularly broad view of the First Amendment, Justice Breyer, his view is even more narrow than Justice Alito's. Dominic, do you have any initial thoughts about how the decision came down or the split in the court?
You see some strange bedfellows on the split in the court. Usually you don't see some of the more liberal justices siding with the more conservative justices, so to speak. And you also usually don't see Scalia and Thomas on opposite sides of an opinion.
Right. So, yeah, the majority of opinion was Scalito. Yeah. Whoops. Scalia, Kennedy, Ginsburg, Sotomayor, and Kagan. Ginsburg, Sotomayor, and Kagan being the three judges on the liberal end, Kennedy being kind of a centrist judge, and Scalia being known for being very conservative. Although Scalia, while being very conservative, it also tends to be kind of fall on the liberal side of things when it comes to First Amendment, some First Amendment issues, and Fourth Amendment search and seizure cases. And then, like I mentioned before, Justice Alito and Roberts, who were on the conservative end, but kind of toward the center of the conservative end, joined together in a concurring opinion. And then Thomas and Breyer filed separate dissenting opinions in this case. So, to make it clear, Thomas and Breyer did not agree, but they both dissented. They both thought that the law should have been upheld.
Albeit in different ways.
Very, very different ways. I think pretty much everyone was shocked, including Scalia, about Thomas's opinion. Thomas's opinion was essentially that because at the founding of the country, children had virtually no rights, there's no reason to think that the First Amendment would have given any rights to children about the ways in which children can express themselves and the access to children, what kind of access people who are making speech would have to children. And in the majority opinion, Scalia kind of points that out and says, nowhere in the history of the Supreme Court have we ever said anything that's, you know, remotely close to this. And in Thomas's opinion, he cites mostly to philosophers, and at one point even cites a Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court case from the early 1800s. So all around, this was it ended up, coming out the way everyone thought it would. But the most interesting part of this case is, by far and away, the concurrences and the dissents. The majority opinion is pretty much straight down the line. It's this is video games are speech just as much as a book is speech. The act imposes restrictions on the content of the speech, which can only be upheld if they're narrowly tailored to further a compelling state interest, which this really is not, and they're not narrowly tailored, even if it were. That wasn't surprising as far as First Amendment jurisprudence goes. Interestingly, before this case was decided, though, in Massachusetts there was a decision, and now presumably overturned, that video games were not protected by the First Amendment. So, one of the areas where video games were not, up until last week, protected by the First Amendment was Massachusetts.
So Massachusetts has just passed a state law saying the First Amendment doesn't apply to video games.
No. It was there was a court case from, God, I want to say the late 70s, early 80s, that says video games like Pac-Man were not protected by the First Amendment. But now, because of the Supreme Court case, I mean, obviously, if our courts were to revisit it, we'd have to find that they were protected by the First Amendment.
So a question that I kind of posed to the Twill panel on Friday was, at what point in time did we start valuing violent expression more than sexual expression? Because as the law stands with the obscenity standards, it's easier for states to regulate sexual expression than it is for them to regulate violent expression. But it's a little odd to me because sexuality seems to be something that every human being has to grow into at some point, whereas violence shouldn't be one of those things.
I mean, even to the Puritans, violence was always more appropriate than sex. So, I mean, I'm not surprised that the law is developed in this way. It's a little ridiculous. And it's also worth noting that, there's a difference between something that's pornographic and something that's obscene. And the law specifically regulates obscenity. I mean, there are limitations on even what pornographic material you can sell to children, and those are reasonable, but, and by reasonable, I mean the courts have found them to be reasonable. But there's still that blanket prohibition on obscene material, which has its own definition that I don't think we particularly need to get into. But it's that definition of obscenity that the California statute was trying to echo in banning violence.
Yeah, and just to be clear, I think that they reached the right conclusion here, and I don't even think that the California law really did what it set out to do by the legislators. It was definitely sweeping in more speech than it should have, and the definition that they use for violent video games, in which to just to remind the our listeners, it's any video game that depicts killing, maiming, dismembering, or sexually assaulting an image of a human being in a manner that a reasonable person would find appeals to a deviant or more morbid interest of children. So, not very clear in terms of what would constitute a violent video game, and since it uses the phrase an image of a human being, it's not clear how that would apply to humanoid images where maybe you're fighting aliens or something like that. And it also leaves out animals in that as well. So, killing, maiming, or dismembering animals would probably not be, would not fall under that. But you could imagine that there would be video games that might still qualify in other people's definitions as violent, that just don't meet the California standard. So, yeah, I think they reached the correct conclusion here that this is probably not the best way to do this, and there are definitely better alternatives with the ESRB and everything. But still, I just sort of wonder from an ideological standpoint, why it is that, it's so much easier to regulate sexual expression than it is to regulate the violence. So that's sort of my roundabout way of saying, I think that there are still some questions that remain in my mind about whether we're treating this the right way, but for now, I think the alternatives for regulation seem to be doing their job.
As a kind of interesting side note to this, for a while there were standards boards that cropped up for things like movies and comic books that basically governed what was okay to put in comic books. And I don't think the Comic Book Association still exists anymore, but I mean there is kind of one for the movies though, as far as the movie rating system. And these cropped up originally in like the 1920s and 30s to avoid to kind of self-impose standards so that they wouldn't be regulated by the government. This was back when it was still a lot easier to put restrictions on forms of speech. And in some way, the game ratings that it's rated M for mature, or I forget what all the other ratings are right now, but those are kind of the same way. That the goal of that was to kind of self-regulate themselves, or at least put on some sort of rating system so that they would eventually try to avoid government regulation of the sale of video games.
It's an interesting legal tactic here that they were trying to basically add a new form of speech. And using that new form of speech, basically say this is like obscenity.
Well, at least we have resolved the question of whether video games can qualify as expression under the First Amendment.
Any last thoughts on this?
All set here.
All set here as well. So I will take us on to our next story, which is about Dropbox, which has been in the news quite a bit recently. You probably heard us talk about them a few weeks ago, when there were some questions about their encryption policies. Now they are back in the news, though, for two different things. One, there was apparently a new security hole that popped up, I think, a week or two ago, where there was some sort of glitch on the system, and users could log in to any account with any password for some reason. And also, they have changed their terms of service agreement on the website, and also the privacy policy and security overview. And according to their blog post, they have made some changes to sort of make these documents easier to read and understand. They also note that they have tried to eliminate as much legalese as possible because they actually want the users to read them. So first, some thoughts, I guess, on the terms of service agreement. What they have changed here are some of the descriptions related to their encryption key management, as well as the data practices, also how they are using data that people are putting into Dropbox and their duplication practices or deduplication practices, which was something that popped up in that first instance of where their encryption policies were questioned. When users would upload files, they would deduplicate the files to try to save storage space on their servers, by noting that if someone had uploaded the same file, they would sort of only store one copy of it, but then allow either user who had uploaded it to download it and have it associated with their account. Another interesting conflict that popped up this week was in relation to the copyright license, which they require users to grant to them. It was actually a pretty simple license, which gives basically Dropbox the right to use any data that the users upload. There was a small, I wouldn't want to call it a user revolt, but people on blogs had questioned whether that this was an okay practice, because they want to know why Dropbox needs a license to be granted from users. And Dropbox also responded to that on their blog, and they said the license is solely to enable Dropbox to technically administer, display, and operate the Dropbox services. So this is, according to Dropbox, something they have to do in order to make the service work from a legal standpoint. They also point out that this is something that's commonly done in other terms of service agreements like Google's, and they even point users to the relevant section in the Google Terms of Service. And also, the last thing of note in this is that Dropbox has also had at least one complaint filed against them to the FTC in relation to the first story that happened a few weeks ago. It's unclear if the FTC is investigating them or this is just merely a complaint that's been filed, but now with the new security flaw that popped up just a week or two ago on with the passwords and having users be able to log into any account, it'd be interesting to see if that becomes the subject of a more formal FTC inquiry. So, kicking this over to the panel, what do you guys think about the story? I know that you are both heavy Dropbox users. Do any of the changes in the terms of service affect you? Do you see them as problematic? or is it just business as usual?
I think it's business as usual. They've since on their blog post updated their noted that they updated their terms of service to say that they only are going to access their your files as is reasonably necessary for the service. The license is solely to enable us to technically administer, display, and operate the services, not to view your content. I'm not particularly disturbed by them, but I think Dominic has a little more to say than I do.
I mean, basically the security holes revealed the rather... I mean, they had some short-sighted changes on their license that they made, and their terms, rather, and they have now published this basically complete rework, and they're essentially saying that they need rights to move your files around, prepare derivative works, and anything of that variety that, in a technical sense, they kind of needed before, but they weren't asking for, because they just sort of assumed it was granted because you're using our service after all. I see it more as the sort of CYA process on their part.
Right. Of course, if they had not asked users to grant those license rights to Dropbox, it's always possible that down the line somewhere users could file a lawsuit for copyright infringement claiming that they never authorized Dropbox to make use of the data in any way, and that would probably implicate their deduplication practices as well.
Yeah, I mean, they say on their blog and in their license basically that this is just to let us run the service. We're not trying to get ownership of your stuff. There were some Twitter people who were freaking out, oh my lord, Dropbox is now going to take our content and sell it to other people. But that's not really what the license is about. I don't think Dropbox would do that, because if they did, they'd probably get sued and also would kill their business entirely.
So on the security front, do you guys still feel that using Dropbox is okay? Is it a secure service?
I mean, it's more for what it does. It's the best option out there. No other website that I know has all the features that Dropbox does, has all the syncing between all the various platforms. Like, there just isn't anything else out there that does all that Dropbox does. They did have a pretty significant security breach, as we talked about, but they responded to it, and I don't know. I still have trust for the company. My information personally wasn't unsecure or anything.
Right, likewise. And I don't keep anything particularly sensitive on my Dropbox, just because I don't trust the cloud that much. So as far as that goes, I'm not particularly concerned.
Yep, but for syncing notes between your iPhone and your desktop or something, it's really handy, or syncing a file you're working on that isn't national security thing. Obviously, it's not supposed to be used for something that needs ironclad security, but as a service for having live backups of pretty much everything you're working on, that's really handy. And if you're a startup developer or something, it's perfectly fine to keep your code in a Git repository that's stored on Dropbox, because you get a nice backup, you can access it from any machine you're at, and it's not like Dropbox is going to steal your information or anything. They're not looking through their code in that sense. But at the same time, if you're a startup and you're doing something that's highly illegal, the FBI can probably gain access to the files of Dropbox, as they can probably gain access to the files of Amazon, because Dropbox just uses Amazon S3, or Gmail, or Google, or anything online. Unless you own the server physically and own the grounds the server is on and aren't in the United States, the FBI can probably gain access to it.
USA Patriot Act, of course, comes into play there, and it's fairly easy for some of the authorities to get access to data under that particular statute. And one thing I forgot to mention is that there has been a lawsuit filed against Dropbox after the June 19th event, and this is the one with the password issue. One of the users has filed a lawsuit in the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of California, it looks like, and it kind of claims what you would expect it to claim, charging that Dropbox has violated the California unfair competition law, and also invasion of privacy claims and negligence claims for allowing the authentication servers to go down, and that's apparently what caused the issue where you can enter in any password and gain access to any particular account. I think, though, that I've started to rethink my theories about some of these lawsuits. It can be pretty difficult unless you can ha unless you have a plaintiff, and if the, I think this might have even been filed as a class action. If you need to have representative plaintiffs that really show injuries in order to recover a lot of damages. If you think back to the Google Buzz litigation, which actually settled just this last March, even though that those events happened more than a year before, the plaintiffs they had there had sort of tenuous injuries, and I think that was one thing that factored into sort of what most people would categorize as a very lenient penalty on Google. The biggest penalties didn't come from the lawsuit; it came from some of the investigations by the state attorneys general and $9 million dollars worth of damages. And that would seem to be much more significant. The Google Buzz case would seem to be much more significant than the Dropbox case was, unless someone comes forward and says, "Hey, look, someone gained access to my Dropbox account," and you know, that caused some particularized injury, and you guys should pay me millions of dollars. I don't really see this being damaging quite at this point. So Ben, did you have any thoughts on the security issue with the passwords?
I mean, it was a debacle and it never should have happened, but they did a fairly good job informing people, one, that it did happen, informing the people who had breaches who were breached, informing everyone else who wasn't breached that they weren't breached. And they even went so far as to say, you know, we don't think it was accessed, but during the time when it could have been accessed, somebody accessed one of your shared folders, should double check. And I knew who it was, so I didn't have a problem with that. And, you know, they handled it really well. So, yeah, I think that's all I have to say. I don't think there are any substantial damages for people to bring any type of class action, and they handled it better than most companies handle security breaches.
So if I understand you correctly, your account was accessed during that time and Dropbox notified you?
No. A shared folder was accessed by somebody else who had access to the shared folder, and they informed me that we don't believe your account was accessed by through the security exploits, but during that time, your shared folder was accessed, not by some security loophole, by somebody who had access to your shared folder.
Oh, okay, I see. Well, I guess I have one final question for you guys, and then we can give the last word to Dominic. What would it take on Dropbox? How egregious of a violation of either privacy or security would it take for you to stop using the service? And can you think of anything that would cause you to migrate maybe to another alternative if there was one, or just to stop using the service altogether?
I mean, someone hacking into their servers and zipping everything up and posting it online would probably be enough to
Yeah.
stop.
Something like that.
Something where it's just complete leaked public and it's like, all right, I'm never going to trust you with my information again.
I was just going to say the reason I ask is because I think there are certainly a number of people who use online services, and they seem to think that there's always going to be some sort of security trade-off, and they almost expect that these types of incidents are just inevitable. They will happen no matter what, and the only way to be prepared for it is to sort of acknowledge that they're going to happen at some point. It's more a question of when, not if, and they're just sort of conscious of the materials that they put into certain cloud-based storage systems. And so it would take quite a bit for them to want to move away from a service just because they treat it like that.
Sort of in that vein, like a lot of people use Dropbox as a SharePoint for something like 1Password. They put their encrypted 1Password file there, and then automatically gets duplicated across the devices. Like I personally do that. And if you're not familiar with 1Password is or KeePass, they're both similar sort of products. The idea is that you have a program that keeps track of all your passwords and will generate passwords for you, and it even has a browser extension that when you go to the site, you can log into your secure with 1Password and then rip out all the other passwords so that if a site does get hacked, your exposure is only the point of that site. So if you were using the Sony PlayStation Network, you have a separate password for that site. So and for every site, basically every site has its own password, and they're all pretty hard to crack because they're automatically generated and they're remembered by a computer because there's no way you're remembering 500 passwords. And that file, that encrypted password file, that is encrypted in itself. So if you're storing anything sensitive in Dropbox, you should apply your own level of security to it, encrypt the file yourself, so that there's at least one more layer of security.
Do you guys use TrueCrypt?
I do not.
No, I'm not familiar with what TrueCrypt is.
It's an encryption program, but one that you would use on your desktop. You can encrypt files. I know a number of people who actually use TrueCrypt to encrypt their files before loading them into Dropbox. So that would be a good example of using your own level of security before adding something to a service like Dropbox.
Yep, that makes perfect sense. I mean, as with anything on the internet, there's an inherent risk posting anything online. But I mean, if you take steps of encryption, like cloud sharing services, then you can minimize your risk. Because even if Dropbox were to get hacked, guess what? Your files are still encrypted. And unless you're someone super important with super important files, probably hackers aren't going to try to bother to crack your encryption. And if you are someone super important with super important file, why are you storing them on Dropbox
Right,
or
you're probably
anything
worth a lot of
public?
money anyway, right? And you should have your own security solution set up for yourself.
Yes. Like, I would be disappointed if President Obama was storing plans on Dropbox.
All right then, so any final questions or thoughts?
All right, our final story is the Federal Trade Commission investigating Twitter on antitrust grounds. Basically, this comes from tiff, I guess, between Uber Media, which has basically a bunch of Twitter clients, and Twitter itself. It sort of came to the head over TweetDeck. Uber Media, which I guess owns a couple of Android Twitter clients, wanted to buy TweetDeck. TweetDeck is an Adobe Air desktop Twitter client of giant proportions. Twitter just recently bought it for $40 million in May. And apparently, basically, the FTC is saying that Twitter has been acquiring all these third-party Twitter clients. Like, they bought Tweety a while ago, and now they've bought TweetDeck and made them official Twitter apps. And Twitter sort of, its initial growth was largely spawned by third-party developers in terms of making it really easy to use Twitter because their website was pretty limited in what you could do originally. The redesign that launched, was it last year or early this year, has expanded what they can do there. But effectively, the FTC is saying, hey, Twitter, you're being anti-competitive towards Twitter clients, potentially, and we're going to take a closer look. I'm not entirely sure I understand why, because, I mean, Twitter is its own platform, and it controls clients to it. It'd sort of be like the FTC investigating Apple, saying, Apple, you're being anti-competitive for other operating systems on Mac hardware. You're not offering Windows on your MacBook Airs. But maybe that analogy isn't quite the best one. I'll throw this to the panel.
Yeah, I think the concern is that Twitter is trying to corner the market on third-party, well, on desktop and mobile applications that can access the Twitter API. And I mean, it's a weird market to have a monopoly on, but if they opened it up initially and now are slowly closing it down through purchasing competitors and using their power over the API to block out other competitors, I mean, it's arguably anti-competitive.
You know, what's a
Sure,
little weird about it is that Twitter, once it was launched, it wasn't that long thereafter, I think, when they opened up their API, and there wasn't necessarily any business model in place. This was like widely reported that no one really knew what Twitter was, how it was going to be used, what were its most useful purposes, but they allowed all these companies basically to spring up startups and create, their own ways of accessing the service through the API, their own software programs. They had almost essentially created a market for this new platform, Twitter. And then now we're sort of learning that, Twitter might sort of be bullying around some of these third-party developers years later. And if you think about it, the market is almost entirely regulated then, if you want to call it a market. And that's a controversial thing, but it's almost entirely regulated by the terms that would apply then to the people using the API. And because of that, Twitter can effectively foreclose entire sections of that market just by changing the terms of the service agreement with the API developers. Or there's also allegations that they are buying a lot of these companies and shutting down some of the applications. without even changing the terms of the API service agreement. So that seems to be what the FTC is interested in. There haven't, as far as I've seen, there haven't actually been any FTC documents that were published. So it's a little unclear to me, but this was reported by the Wall Street Journal as well as businessinsider.com. So I think that's our source for the story.
Yeah, and it's worth correcting this. They did actually shut down API access for one of Uber Media's apps for 5 days or so when Uber Media was investigating buying TweetDeck on the grounds that Uber Media had violated several provisions of their terms of service. Uber Media then worked with Twitter to resolve the issues, and service to its apps that had lost service was restored. So it might just be particular coincidence. Just bad timing. Might not be, which is probably why the FTC is being like, let's take a closer look at this.
I'm sure they got a nudge or so from some of these API developers.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a lot of crying lately over Twitter basically saying, all right, we don't really want you guys making any more Twitter apps. We're just going to use our official apps, and you guys can go do your own thing. But yeah, don't make apps that look like the official apps or do anything the official apps do, which is kind of in kind of a reversal of their entire policy from the start, because originally they were like, hey, go have fun, here's our API, we don't really know what this service is, help us create it. And now that they've sort of defined that service, they're trying to, I guess, lock it down.
And so, in other words, like, why don't you guys do all the creative stuff, create some really cool applications to access our service, and then we're going to kind of use some of those ideas that you do and then also shut down your access to the API. Or at least that's what it sounds
Yeah.
like.
It's also worth noting that in March of this year, Twitter actually settled with the FTC over unrelated privacy violations.
Right. So, are we in a new era now where we're like revisiting the Microsoft-like cases with both Google being investigated now on the basis of its search engine and its advertising model, and now with Twitter and API access? Are these the new platforms?
Maybe. And in the vein of Twitter security violations, on today, July 4th, the date of this recording, hackers have actually hacked into Fox News Politics Twitter account and posted fake tweets regarding the president, kind of egregiously so. I'm not sure that's a fault of Twitter in any sense. It's probably there was an insecure password somewhere along the way, and they found their way out.
Well, security issues certainly seem to be the theme of this year so far, at least the last couple of months. Fair to say.
Any final thoughts on this story?
I'm
Oh,
all set.
my take is that I think we'll figure out a little bit more about what the FTC inquiry is about when there are some official statements by the FTC, whether those come in the form of something that is issued in a press conference or in an actual document posted on their website. Until then, it's a little hard to gauge exactly what it is they're investigating and what the impetus was for the investigation to begin with. I'm kind of curious what the antitrust policy is going to look like going forward with API access to services like Facebook and Twitter, and then there, other things that are going on that are pretty interesting, like the Google search and search neutrality issues that seem to be popping up.
Ben, any final thoughts, or are you all set?
I'm all set.
All right. In that case, I'd like to thank our listeners for listening to our podcast. As always, you can find us online at technicallylegal.org, or you can follow our RSS feed and subscribe to our podcast. You can find us on Twitter. Our account has not been hacked at techlegal. You can email us any thoughts, comments, questions, ideas, suggestions, complaints, or other things you might want to send us at podcast@technicallylegal.org. Signing off, I'm Dominic Grabe.
I'm Ben Snitkoff.
And I'm David O'Brien.
Thanks for listening, and have a happy 4th of July week.